Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
Hi, and welcome back to the Holistic Women's Health Podcast. On today's episode, I'm talking with Dr. Kyra Bobinette. Kyra has passionately pursued and studied the truth about behavior change for nearly three decades as a physician, public health leader, healthcare executive, and behavioral expert. She belongs to the Stanford Medical School, where she has taught on health behavior change and is the CEO and founder of Fresh Tri, that's T-R-I, a behavioral software based on the latest neuroscience of habit formation and lasting change. Kyra is an enrolled member of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe in Minnesota. She enjoys meditation, horsemanship, and herbalism, and she lives with her family in the Santa Cruz Mountains.
This is a topic that in my years of being a practitioner is the base of everything. It's anytime I talk with someone for their health goals, it's all about behavior. So in the past few years, I've been delving into the subject. So I'm excited to see your perspective on it as well. But before I ask you about goals and SMART goals and your opinion on that, what inspired you to pursue a career in behavioral change and neuroscience?
Yeah, I think that as children, we're kind of born one way. And my sort of retrospective thread is that I always cared about one thing, which is, do I do what I actually know I should do? Because as a kid, having struggled with procrastination, with getting my homework done in early years and kind of being more artistically minded versus, regimented and conscientious, I struggled with the gap between what I know I should do and what I do. Then when I matured into being a scientist and a doctor, a clinician, I saw that as the primary problem in all of health, and wellness, is this gap between what we know we should do and what we actually do. And that cuts across every domain, whether as a parent or as in a relationship with somebody or trying to eat healthy or trying to exercise, trying to sleep well, whatever domain your career, whatever domain you're talking about, wherever there's gaps, it's actually in psychology called the no-do gap, then we are, really stuck. And that's kind of the universal stuckness that we all face.
And why don't we, if we know how to do something, why don't we actually do it?
Right. So in the past, because we didn't know the neuroscience, we didn't have access to what I'm going to share as the latest neuroscience, we made the mistake of blaming ourselves. A lot of people blame themselves as I'm not motivated, or there I go again, nothing works for me, like I'm a quitter, I'm a failure, all kinds of self-indictment sits in that gap because we don't really know the truth. So now we are lucky enough to have, to be alive at a time when the truth is actually coming out and it's going to change everything. So the truth is there's a little part of our brain called the habenula, H-A-B-E-N-U-L-A for the listeners, which is a half centimeter. There's two of these on either side of the midline in the middle part of your brain above what's called the thalamus. And this little teeny tiny pea-sized thing is actually the reason why we experience, I know what I should do, I just don't do it. And the way that works is that if we think, if we try for something, or if we want to do something, I know what I should do, and then we don't do it, or it doesn't work out exactly as we planned, and this is where it kind of ties into SMART goals eventually, then we experience like a perceived failure. That's a long way of saying that we might feel disappointed or frustrated or demoralized or disappointed, whatever the cousins of failure are. So may not resonate with somebody say, oh, I don't feel like a failure if I don't walk 3 miles when I intended to, but your brain counts it. Your brain keeps track of every promise you make, every intention you make, every part of your word that is not true, you know? And then when there's a gap between what I say and what I do, then, or what I hope and what I do, then there's a failure signal. And that lights up this little habenula, this little pea-sized habenula lights up. And that's the worst scenario for you. You do not want this part of your brain to light up, because if it lights up, the second thing it's going to do is it's going to cause motivation loss. It's going to kill your sense of rewards. It's going to throw you into a sense of anhedonia, if not full depression, depending on how big a deal it is to your brain. And it controls all of your behaviors. And so then you don't do the thing that you wished you would do as a result. And so that is what we've noticed for so many decades, like this gap between what we know we should do and we just don't do it. Now we know the neuroscience behind what's happening in that little chasm.
So how can we not go into that perceived failure? Do we set smaller goals? How do we train ourselves to build on that momentum of the positivity and checking those boxes and to lead us into actually achieving our goals?
Yeah, I think that we've been using goals and holding it by the pointy end, by the sharp end. So if goals are a knife, you know, the safe way to hold it is by the handle, which is to say that if I set a goal or an aim or an intention for myself, it better be either coded in ways that I'm not a failure if it doesn't happen exactly as I predicted, or after the fact, I have a good muscle around letting go of my previous expectations or my previous preferences and being able to flow with whatever happened, make that okay, accept it. There's things called like acceptance therapy that are useful for that. But having the what's called cognitive flexibility to like not get stuck on the failure or the story of failure that my brain is telling me and be able to either reframe it so that it means something different or let it go so that I'm releasing or surrendering to what is. Those are some ways out of that no-do gap, terrible space. And by the way, when your habenula goes off or you think you failed, you don't have like a sharp pain to the neck. It's not like, ouch, you know, like you don't know it happened. And so the only way that we can really track this within ourselves is starting with, where do I know what I should do and I'm not doing it? I had this recently where I procrastinated on something really, really important that I was going to apply to, right? And it was important to business. And yet I was stuck. I didn't do it. And it was like a couple of hours before the deadline and I was spinning and spinning and spinning. And then I realized like, you know, cause I was spinning in, oh, here I go again. I'm procrastinating again. Like that whole storyline. And instead of that, I was like, wait a minute, I don't have motivation to do this. That is my first clue that some perceived failure type is going on in my mind. And then how can I track that where I can start to either reframe it, talk myself out of it, or let it go, right? So I did that and I realized that I had this feeling of not being able to call my loved one, my daughter, in a time of need because I didn't have time. But then that got me stuck in not doing this other thing because I was just kind of like betwixt between. And so once I really identified the little core of the problem, then I made a plan for how to circle back to her. And I resumed my motivation to do the thing that was on the deadline.
I'm having a lot of epiphanies as you speak. My notes are looking pretty wild. But one thing that was resonating with me was you explaining that we shouldn't be avoiding these failures. If they're going to happen, just either reframe them or let it go. And I can imagine that would be really hard for people who see things in black and white. Either I achieved or I failed. So coming, let's say, from someone, I know a lot of my clients are like this, and they set big goals and it's very black and white. So how can someone learn to reframe and look more into the gray?
Yeah, that's one very distinctive, what I call a failure type in the book. And that is an all or nothing failure type. It's been well documented in the psychological research. And it is a tough one because it's the opposite of what I was saying. Cognitive flexibility is when you can move from one thing to the next without a lot of stickiness to the old idea. You can let go of things, that kind of thing. So in the clients that struggle with that the most, the thing to do is to have a reframe exercise where you're able to talk about all the ways in which it may not have been true. You know, it may not have been exactly true what your mind is concluding. Maybe it's like this, maybe it's like that. Just even that little seed of like, do I really know this is true? Absolutely true. You know, and there's a really amazing teacher named Byron Katie who originally came up with this idea of the work, right? Which is to question the narrative that our mind is telling us so that it helps you kind of, it shows the water to the fish and gets you out of the immersion of that and uses your what's called metacognitive brain to actually look at your narrative brain and say, maybe not, you know? So that helps people who are stuck in that way. And I go through different failure disease types that I have noticed in my career and in my practice. And then I also go over what I've noticed to be helpful for each type of failure disease. We're at the beginning of this conversation because, you know, knowing about that benula now brings failure into the conversation. Whereas everybody, including myself in my past self, have been all focused on performing, you know, positive, success, keys to success, all that kind of stuff. It turns out paradoxically that the key to success is in fact managing the failure, not managing the success. And again, that's because this new insight around the habenula loss, our brains are twice as sensitive to loss as they are to gain. So you get two times the amount of effect on your outcomes by dealing with the loss side of the equation, not dwelling on it, but reframing it, reclaiming that energy. You know, that's where the stuckness comes from, is all of that. You know, failure narrative, self-blame, all that kind of stuff. It's a waste of time. And in fact, in certain long-term studies, like the National Weight Loss Registry is one where they measure like 10,000 people and what causes long-term weight loss, right? And usually it's got this layer of like fads, you know, like, oh, I eat breakfast, or I mean, nothing against that. I think that's great. But for the longest time, I was able to manage my weight without eating breakfast. And now I need to, and I want to eat breakfast. But what's really interesting about that data is that the people who actually lose weight and keep it off long-term are the ones with the shortest periods of relapse. So they're getting on the horse faster, that they're not wallowing in the fact that they got bucked off, or they are reframing quickly and they're getting back up on the horse so that they can keep going. Because it's really about, you know, minutes on the clock that you are in effort towards what you want versus getting mired down in some habenular, you know, moment or hit, motivation loss and stuckness.
How do we keep our motivation high if the people who are more likely to succeed have those shorter periods of relapse? I know sometimes we fall off the bandwagon or we have that failure. And sometimes it's like, well, my motivation is gone. How do I get back on the horse and keep going?
Yeah. And that's where the detective side of you, you know, can activate. Like, whenever you have motivation loss, number one, do not blame yourself. Number two, realize that that is a triggered event. That is something that was triggered that you didn't consciously see or feel. And then your detective side can say, okay, what was it that kind of swept my legs? You know, like that got that I'm sitting here on my butt. When you look at it that way, most people can detect what it is that they might have been a failure trigger for them, you know, that caused them to feel like they failed or that they couldn't, or those kinds of things. Or here we go again, some narrative that was tripped off. But even if you don't, if your personality isn't one to assess all those things, what I find in my research is that there's another group of people that when they get the legs swept and they're on their butts, they just go, well, I'm going to iterate my way through this. That they're a very problem solving kind of forward, you know, in a tinkering kind of group, you know, so there's one group that likes to know what is it that got my goat and let's figure out how I get back on the horse. And the other group is, I don't care what got my goat. I'm just going to fix that. You know, I'm going to figure out how I get back up on this horse. You know, I'm going to stand myself up. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that differently. And they start what's called iterating, which sets them apart. And it turns out that in our research, iteration is the key to long-term change of any kind that you want. I've never seen a person who is successful, wildly successful, able to achieve their goals, able to do things that other people admire, you know, influencers, whatever the case may be, who is not iterating constantly on what they're doing and how to get themselves to do it.
I know you talk about the iterative mindset method a lot in your book, and I've heard you on other podcasts. Can we dive deeper into the subject and talk more about how this is the key and some examples?
Yeah. So in 30 years, you know, I have tried every other kind of method. I have tried everything, every popular method, everything that's in the literature, everything that was espoused, everything that was new, every crazy idea you could imagine on millions and millions of people. And what I found over and over again is that all of those approaches were short-term acting and long-term relapsing, up to like 99% relapse. So it, and then also, if you think about it, if I relapse on something that I used to be able to do, then that's another type of failure, you know, and my habenula is on, and it's going to prevent me from having motivation to try something else. Even when that one thing is gone, or that program's gone, or that one person that I like, that therapist or that coach or that, you know, nutritionist, whoever, is now out of my life, then I can't get something new in my life because I'm so dwelling on the past. And so what we want to do, or what I noticed in my research, I should say, is that there was one thing only that was common to all people who got long-term behavior change in some form or fashion. And I articulated it as three variables in the iterative mindset. Not all of this is in the book. So the book talks about iteration piece of that because it's so new to everybody. But there's three variables that really successful people did. One is that they would neutralize any failure in the assess portion of that mindset. And that means everything that happened in the past, they neutralized it or let it go. Or even going forward, they protected themselves from failure by the way they were thinking about it, not being so hard and rigid and smart goalie and things like that. The second thing they did is that they experimented as a practice. So they practiced instead of set goals and tracked. So right now the standard is goals and track, like, you know, and tracking does have a good role for awareness. You know, if I'm just shoveling in two bags of chips at night and then working out and being like, why am I not getting healthier? You know, then tracking that I'm eating two bags of chips might be helpful, right? But for the long term, and the sort of secret to their success was that they were experimenting constantly. They were practicing a new thing, much like you would practice a sport or a musical instrument or a skill of other kinds. And then the third component, which was the magical ingredient, was that instead of failing, these people would iterate their way through challenges, through, you know, leveling up in what they wanted to accomplish, those kinds of things. And so if you look again at any professional person who is admirable, any famous person, any, you know, athlete, anything like that, they are constantly iterating to be able to get to the level that they're at.
And the iterating in your book, the longhand, inspiration, time, environment, reduce, add, togetherness, expectations, and swaps. Are you still using that?
Yeah. So that's a really long, non-mentally portable acronym that's just for the reader to do a little slow brain exercise with, because a lot of people, it's not yet in the zeitgeist, this iteration idea. Certainly out here in Silicon Valley, the home of, you know, technology, we have iteration. Everybody pretty much knows what that is. But for those who are not from that field, iteration is basically you're versioning in it, you know, constantly improving version over version, 1.0, 2.0, 3.0, until you get the thing that works for you. And then even then, that will work for a while. And then you've got to go back and iterate. So the iterates model that you just mentioned, all those variables are just almost like prompts for people's own creativity when they're trying to solve a specific problem. And I really advise people to go through that whole list around a problem that they're trying to iterate on, just as prompts to see which ones light up for them around that particular problem. But just to get used to like the, that's the slow way. And then they can pick up speed and kind of use shortcuts in terms of on the fly and livability later on.
Could you talk about the slow brain versus fast brain?
Yeah, that was my first book. So, you know, this is a shortcut based on Daniel Kahneman's and his colleagues' theory around, you know, Thinking Fast and Slow was the book. And it's a very wonderful book, but it is, you have to have a certain tolerance for multisyllabic scientific terms, because there's a lot of that in there. So if that's not, it's not an easy read. So what I did is I just reduced that down to basically slow brain and fast brain. Fast brain is all the habitual, you know, shortcuts and assumptions and biases and what's called heuristics, which is like a mental shortcut of, you know, if I say, hey, you know, name five pieces of fruit, like that's your fast brain, you know, name 36 pieces of fruit or types of fruit, that's your slow brain, because you run out of fast brain pretty quick. And then you're digging for, you know, like you might be Googling for different things, you know, so that you can answer the question. So that's most of the time our brain's preference is to be in fast brain. We jump to conclusions all the time because of this. It's even been shown that as we're listening to somebody's voice, let's say somebody's listening to my voice right now, they're only capturing a little over 50% of what I'm actually saying, and their brain is filling in the rest of the meaning because their attention span is bouncing around and they're not, you know, they're not a long-term meditator from some cave or something like that where they've cultivated that level of focus stability, right? So the brain's coming in to like fill in the details, and that's why we get things so wrong. And that's why, you know, once we do an eyewitness report, it's already flawed compared to like a hidden camera view. And so the slow brain is reserved for problem solving, you know, really difficult problems, really deliberate things that you need to plan out. Those like, you know, hard conversations, you know, where you're fully present, but it's taking all of your brain power to do it. And we can all also probably notice moments in our lives where we see, I'm this way with math. My husband has instant mental math. He can just calculate anything. Looking at the bill on a restaurant, he can calculate the tip at whatever percent you give him. It's kind of weird that way. But I look at a math problem and I know I could do it, but I'm lazy. My fast brain is like, hey, hun, can you calculate this for me? And I won't even go there, you know, because I'm just being lazy. And I'm just, my slow brain's like, nope, I want to spend my time on something else. So that's basically how our whole life is divided up.
That's so interesting. I'm the same way. Anything that comes to numbers, my brain just instantly shuts off and it's like, nope.
Not me.
And yeah, my mom is the other way. She can just instantly, if we're going shopping and we're in the States, she'll just do the conversion from Canadian dollars to US so quickly in her brain. And I always ask her, how do you do that? And she said she taught herself, and just through that repetition, now she just knows it. It comes very easily for her.
Yeah.
But another question I had for you, based on what you were talking about earlier with applying to that opportunity that was going to be really good for your business, why do we hold ourselves back from doing things that are good for us? And why do we put that mental block in? Is it just because it's difficult, it takes effort, or if we know it's good for us, why don't we just do it?
So the habenula, one of its superpowers is kind of looking ahead to predict. It makes predictions. And so it's predicting whether this is going to work out for you or it's a bad idea. And so whenever you have a stutter or a hesitation or procrastination towards something that you think you really could benefit from, that usually reflects that there's some past history that your habenula is using to say, oh no, that doesn't work out for you. Let's say that you are a little kid and you want to learn how to sing, and then you're in the middle of like puberty. And so then you start to sing in the school chorus in seventh grade or whatever, and then your voice cracks and everybody laughs. Habenula remembers that, you know, so that when it comes to singing later on, let's say you're in high school or you're a young adult and you want to join a group of people who sing, then you've got what I call a habenula scar, which is like, oh no, you know, that doesn't work out for you. Public singing doesn't work out for you, kind of thing. And you have to overcome that with, again, reframing that past failure that stole your motivation to do the thing that you otherwise want to do, so that you can get back your motivation and do what you want to do, which is the joining the chorus as an adult.
How does the habenula work if someone has, let's say, a fear of success? So they are doing really well, but then they're doing too well. So then they kind of freeze and panic, even though the motivation's high, the numbers are coming in, everything's doing really well.
Yeah, there's two versions of that in the failure disease categories. One is called pre-failing, which is like, oh, that's not going to work out for me because of, you know, so-and-so, or I'm inadequate. Then there's also imposter syndrome, which is a version of future thinking where you feel like you're going to be outed, you're going to be exposed in the future. And that's a form of failing too, which is that, oh, I'm not failing now, but I will in the future when people find out exactly how incompetent or whatever, what a sham this is. And so both of those things are set up for failure triggers to the habenula, cause motivation loss at some point, you know. So in the pre-failing sense, you might see somebody not even try because they've already decided that's not going to work out for them. In the imposter syndrome side, you have somebody who's incredibly anxious that it's just a matter of time before the shoe drops. Right. And they're already fearing that. But then they start to lose motivation over time because of this complex that's going on in their anxiety.
Another question I had for you is basically, where do we start to setting these goals for success? Early in your book, I know you talk about SMART goals, and this is not the way to go. So where do we start? Do we start with an identity change? Should we start with future self journaling, reprogramming our subconscious? Where do we go?
Yeah, the only fail-safe mechanism I've ever seen is iteration. So, you know, I come from a world where there's really brilliant people designing things that are more easy to do, you know, like smaller steps or atomic habits, those kinds of things. And those lower the chances that you'll fail, but eventually you will fail. You know, even if you have a goal of, you know, doing one push-up a day, you will eventually fail at that because one day you'll get sick or you'll hurt your shoulder or you forgot, whatever the case may be. So that those very specific SMART goals or the miniature versions of those, you know, these little habits, the little habits are better than SMART goals because SMART goals tend to be more lofty. They're not as strict around being tiny. But even the smaller versions of those, because they are so specific, it gives you a sharp object in which to hurt yourself. And so the main thing is to protect yourself from the pointy end of the SMART goal. So if people are going to use SMART goals, they better have a failure mitigation plan. They better have a way to neutralize any failure that comes from using those implements, those tools. But the better, more safe thing that I've never seen anybody fail with is iteration. Because if it doesn't work out, then you're just like, oh, I just need to iterate now. You know, like I'll iterate on this and all that kind of thing. And that's even better in our data that we've seen. Iteration is even more powerful than both performance-based goals as well as learning-based goals. So even if my objective is to just learn from this experience, iterations is still superior to that in terms of long-term change and long-term effort and long-term results.
So we can start from anywhere and then we just continue to iterate iterate, change, be that 2.0, 3.0.
Thinking of things as iterations. Exactly. Let's say you start a new exercise regimen, like a yoga class or whatever. You fall in love and you're in the honeymoon phase and you're like, this is it. I'm done. I'm going to do this forever. And then, you know, the life cycle of it, kind of the luster wears off or it becomes inconvenient or it conflicts with your family life or whatever the case may be, and or get injured, whatever happens. When you go into that yoga love affair in the beginning and you know about iteration, you see yoga as an iteration. And the iteration may be days, weeks, years, decades long for you. I just spoke to somebody yesterday who's in the middle of like almost multi-decades of martial arts training. And that's great. But realize that everything comes to an end. You know, it might be that you're an old lady or whatever the case may be, and you don't want to do yoga anymore, or you move to something else. It's an iteration. You just don't know where the expiration date is. There's no way to tell when it's going to expire for you in particular. And then that prevents you, knowing that coming into it, it prevents you from blaming yourself for a natural thing happening, like iteration, the next iteration. And also looking more quickly for, okay, what's next for me? I have to go find my new love. I have to go find the next thing that's going to activate me to do something in the positive direction.
It's interesting just realizing I often don't think of things having an end. Oftentimes, let's say if I do yoga and I fall in love with it, I never think about it coming to an end. So that's an interesting way to think about it too.
I think Western society has such an issue with death. Maybe that's what's casting the shadow here, is that, you know, we just never think that things are going to end. We don't plan for that. We don't precondition ourselves to understand that. And so then when it does, it's a big problem. It's a big surprise shock. You know, it's oh my gosh, like it was natural. It's part of the natural cycle of things.
100%. People definitely have an issue with death. And another question I wanted to ask you as well is how our environment can play a role in shaping some of these behaviors. I know you have a background in public health, which is something I studied for my dietetics degree as well. And we talked about food deserts and things like that. So if someone's wanting to set these healthy goals, but their environment is really preventing them from achieving that, how can we get around that?
Yeah, my original research where I found iterative mindset was in people who lived in food deserts and who had every possible social determinant of health that you could imagine to throw at them. And I'm not saying it's easy, and I'm not saying even that it's sustainable for everybody, because at some point I have traveled myself and I have a really big food restriction around vegetable oils and seed oils. And so I have trouble finding anything to eat when I travel. There's nothing that I can have. And so, except raw nuts or some crazy thing that I don't find tasty. And so I can totally understand that beyond a certain point, the food desert will win. You know, you have to find little gold veins. Maybe, you know, my sister lives in a food desert in rural Iowa, but they also have farmers who have big gardens because multi-generations of farmers make vegetables. And so at least in the summer, she has her own little farmer's market of people putting out like a little table out in front of their house and just saying, here's some corn, here's some zucchini, because they have extra, you know? And so there's that free natural food, you know, that she has learned to then cook, you know, which is the internet. And the internet, you know, every information is free. So, you know, being able to be motivated is now the contact point between a lot of resources that didn't exist when you were fully isolated. But way back before the internet, if you lived in a food desert, you couldn't get out of it at all. But now there's ways to invent, there's ways to network, there's ways to kind of resource yourself in a different way. And what I'll say, though, is that if you are going to make a poor environment, and I mean resource poor environment, more abundant, then again, the only thing that I found in the research that I did across the United States and into Canada was to iterate and find your people, find your things, find your tools, even we have Walmart here that was the sort of initial instigator of the research. And they sell the most produce and the most organic produce of any other retailer in the US. And so it's something where there's unexpected places where you can get things that you would not even think of.
Another question I had for you in terms of the habit changes and goal settings, I find everyone says something a little bit different. How long does it actually take to form a habit?
The hard science is that it takes at least a year. It gets easier up until that year. But let's say that you just bought a baby tree, you know, you wouldn't expect it to be a full grown, you know, fruit bearing tree or whatever in a couple months. So it's about the same life cycle where you've got a tree that comes to maturity in about a year. You've got, you know, a habit that comes to maturity in a year. The good news, though, is that it gets easier and easier and easier. The more you invest in this part of your brain that is building this pathway for you to live like this. And that's what a habit is when you have it as part of your automatic, mindless brain, your fast brain. It's like the way you do something. And to prove that to oneself, you know, think about the exercise where you interlace your fingers, you know, and you've got like one thumb that's your default thumb on top. And then try the other thumb, like if you want to like really challenge yourself and feel how that feels. That is clearly not a habit. So your default thumb on top is what a habit feels like. It feels like nothing. Doing the opposite thumb on top is the not a habit. And that would take a good year of practicing interlacing my hands with my left thumb on top for that to feel natural. And then the right thumb on top is always there. It's not like your brain does a full replace. It might fall into disrepair. It might become more weaker over time, because if I really practice left thumb on top, at some point my brain's like, gotcha, you want to live with your left thumb on top. But right thumb on top is always an option. And so one of the biggest mistakes when people build habits is they're like, oh no, my right thumb's on top again. Of course, because it's always there. No big deal. Just go get on your horse, put your left thumb on top, and you're off to the races again. And you're putting more investment in that future than you are freaking out about the past.
Should we be making ourselves uncomfortable more frequently to make ourselves more malleable? Is there a way to train the habenula? So often if we do that, I'm noticing my left thumb, as I just put my hands together, wants to be on top. So should I put my other hand on top more frequently to get uncomfortable? What are your thoughts?
I think recognizing that it is uncomfortable, first of all, just be honest about that. You know, like there's no cheating nature, you know? And so even if I do, like for some people who are doing GLP-1s for weight loss, even if I do GLP-1s for a period of time on weight loss, I might eat less pie. But if all I had was pie before that, I'm just going to eat less of it. I'm not going to eat suddenly broccoli, you know? So there is a habit formation thing. It buys you time to be on a GLP-1, but it's not something you want to do for the rest of your life, because you'll lose all your muscle mass. So it's something that is good for a period. It's an iteration that helps you to get a boost on certain things that might feel a little bit out of reach because you're so locked into your old habits, and gives you that space of mind to be able to go, okay, let's practice other thumb on top. Yeah, it's itchy. Yeah, it's uncomfortable. And to your point, being able to just relax in the midst of something that's a little bit uncomfortable is a good skill to like reprogram how you think about it. Because if you have those hard edges inside your mind of like, no, I got to get back to the old thing, that alone is enough to like spring you into relapse and then cause you to feel like you failed at something and that you're at war with yourself inside. And so it's a real setup for, hey, you know, can I get myself to whatever? And if it's too uncomfortable, if it's too itchy, if it's too unbearable, that's where iteration comes in, because you're too far away from what you really are comfortable doing.
Are there any current emerging trends in this field of behavioral change that's really exciting you right now? Anything new that's either coming from your research or someone else's research that's interesting you?
You know, I feel like, you know, habenula is big enough news. It was discovered in the late 1800s, and then we thought it did nothing like the appendix for the longest time. And only about, you know, 15, 20 years ago did it start to get interesting. And now it is the number one thing that is controlling everything. So to me, in my storied career, it is the most powerful behavior control ever found, and no one knows about it yet. So if we just get the word out about that, I think it'll really awaken in people a level of wisdom and creativity that they can apply to their lives, especially if they know also to iterate, to get around and to neutralize their habenula and keep it nice and quiet. That to me would be radical change. It's like in medicine, there's the world before we knew about bacteria and then the world after we knew about bacteria. It's that significant. And so in my thinking, there's people who know about the habenula and there's people who don't know about the habenula. Like, it divides the world asunder in that way for me. And so like your podcast, your listeners are among the early people to even hear about how significant this is and even have anything different to offer, because we've been running the same program, Weight Watchers, like all these things for so long. We can feel how antiquated and we can feel how ineffective these things are. And we're hungry for something new, and we're hungry for something better that actually works, that feels more natural, right? And that's this thing, that's iteration, that is seeing things through a lens of like, what's the habenula doing here? You know, knowing those things are so empowering, and really, I hope, gives people every reason to stop wasting their energy blaming themselves in any way.
As you're talking about being at war with yourself and that internal conflict within yourself, mm-hmm. is meditation something you use and recommend?
Yes, I have been meditating since 99. What I'll say is, don't think of meditation as like a peaceful exercise and it will go better for you. Think of it as almost like you would stretch a muscle. Like you're creating focus, you're creating openness, you're creating mental flexibility, depending on the meditation technique that you are using. Any of those things can happen. But most people go to meditation because they're like, oh, I just want to feel better. I want to feel like unstressed. You know, as Pema Chodron, a very renowned Buddhist teacher, says, poor choice. If you're coming to a meditation retreat to feel more peaceful, poor choice, poor you. And I tend to agree with that. But I think that the cognitive flexibility of meditation in many cases is really helpful, because it allows you to have muscle to not just get carried downstream with your what's called a default mode network and like your monkey mind, your ruminations and your storytelling that your brain does to you. And you have some way of holding in the midst of that flow or that current, and not getting swept downstream into that current. And just that allows you to have some perspective and say, maybe I'm not failing at this thing. Maybe I'm not the worst piece of whatever on the planet. You know, like it calls into question the reality that we're otherwise swimming inside of.
I appreciate you for really talking about the subject, and the habenula was totally new to me. So I'm really grateful to you too. Yeah. I've talked with a lot of people and nobody's talking about this. So I'm excited to see where you bring the habenula into the future and really educate and bring awareness to this topic. And your new book is the one that I read. I haven't read the old one, but your new book is so beautiful. And something I didn't realize until I got to the end of your book, because I noticed little butterflies at the beginning of every chapter, and there were quotes all throughout that I loved and stories everywhere. And it wasn't until I reached the end of your book that I realized that your name in your traditional manner is Butterfly Woman. And I thought, that is so beautiful, and a butterfly is so meaningful and spiritual.
Yeah, and credit to my elders for naming me that.
It's a beautiful name. And tell us where everyone can get the book. And I know you have the app as well, Fresh Try. So tell us where people can find you, connect with you.
Yeah. My personal website is drkyrabobinet.com. And there you can have, we put up an iterative mindset score, so you can measure your own mindset, see what that means for you. We're going to have special releases of special, you know, like you said, this is the only place to get this information except for PubMed at this point. And so unless you want to read a bunch of scientific papers, like, we'll help translate everything into practice, forming a community around this of thought leaders, people who are creatives, who are trying to apply this to their own health and wellness, as well as their clients, their patients, et cetera. So lots to come on that front. Fresh Try is the software based on iterative mindset that we created over the last 10 years. And folks, there's always going to be a free version. So, you know, try that out. See if it helps you to iterate on your health and wellness.
After this, I'm going to go take that quiz.
Excellent.
And see what my mindset is like. But I appreciate you so much for being on. This was such a fantastic conversation.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you learned a lot about new ways to set goals. If you are struggling with your health and you don't know what goals to set, and you really want to work on your hormones and actually feeling good in your body, then feel free to set up a free 15-minute call with me. I offer tons of different services for whatever women's health condition you have. Whether it's PCOS, endometriosis, painful periods, missing periods, acne is a big one that I've been seeing a lot in my clinic as well. And also, if there's anything that you want to hear on the podcast, any topic you're curious about, definitely reach out to me and let me know. I'm on Instagram at Nutrition Moderation, and I'll also leave a link to a form that you can fill out with any guests or topics that you want to hear. Otherwise, if you like this episode, feel free to share it with a friend who needs to hear this information. You can also subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. I'm also online at nutritionmoderation.com. And if you or anyone you know is a web designer, also please let me know, because I would love to do a little revamp of my website. So also reach out to me if you do web design. I hope you have an amazing day wherever you are, and I'll chat with you very soon.